We're talking about the work to get astronauts back to the moon and then on to Mars. It's a look inside NASA here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So NASA awarded hundreds of millions of dollars of big ticket contracts last week, advancing its mission for establishing a long-term sustainable human presence on and around the moon through the Artemis mission. What do you want to know about this crewed lunar exploration? Should we be sending humans to the moon? How do you feel about exploring Mars? We're at 800-642-1234. Ryan Watkins is a research scientist studying planetary surfaces with the Planetary Science Institute. She is a research associate at Washington University in St. Louis. Ryan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's say all goes as planned. In late 2024, a lander carrying NASA astronauts on board sets down on the lunar surface on this Artemis 3 mission. Where might the spacecraft land?
Yeah, the plan right now is to land in the South Polar region. So there's a couple reasons for this, one of which being there may be water ice in that area. So we want to send humans somewhere where there are resources that they could use while they're on the surface. The exact landing site hasn't been selected yet, but it will be the most likely the South Polar region.
But there are so many other regions of the moon. Is it because of that icy water condition why the South Pole is so appealing?
Yeah, that's one of the main reasons. There's also, so at the South Polar regions, there are areas that are actually in permanent shadow because they've never seen sunlight just because of, you know, the orientation of the moon relative to the sun. And some of these deep craters are just shielded from sunlight. So it's in these areas that we think the water ice may persist. But actually, there are also areas that have permanent sunlight that very rarely, if ever, see shadow. So those are also good locations to send humans because you always have sunlight for things like power. So there are a couple reasons. Those are kind of two of the big ones.
So what do you know about the craters on the moon and what caused them?
Yeah, so craters on the moon are caused by impacts. So essentially meteorite impacts that hit the surface and they, you know, create these kind of bowl shapes called craters. On the Earth, we don't see as many craters. There are craters, you know, Meteor Crater in Arizona is kind of the classic one. But on Earth, we have the atmosphere to kind of break up a lot of these impacts. But the moon doesn't have that. So the surface of the moon is essentially saturated with these craters.
Mm. And you study the surfaces. You have this special camera that makes it possible. Can you tell us about the work you do?
Yes. So I am on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Camera Science Team. So Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO for short, has been in orbit around the moon since 2009. So going on 11 years now, or I guess it is 11 years now. Mm-hmm. So this orbiter has a suite of instruments that take various types of measurements of the lunar surface. And the one that I'm primarily involved with is the camera system. We actually have two cameras. Well, it's technically three cameras, but two camera systems. One is a wide angle camera. This kind of takes your broader swath images. So just much, much wider areas it can cover. And then the narrow angle camera system is the one that I work with. So these are the highest resolution images of the lunar surface that we've ever acquired. They go anywhere from about half meter to a meter per pixel in resolution. And so, yeah, so I study these images and look at what they can tell us about the surface, primarily through reflectance. So that's my kind of area of expertise. We call it photometry, just fancy word for studying what the reflectance properties of the surface tell us about things like composition, physical properties, you know, like grain size, roughness, things like that. And it's kind of nice because, you know, I can apply these methods to areas all over the moon to address a wide range of science questions.
I would imagine it just like opening up your computer and saying, ooh, what images do I have to look at today? Might be like opening a bag of candy for you.
Yes. I have gotten quite lost in these images for probably longer periods of time than I should admit sometimes. Just looking. Yeah, there's just so much to see and they're just so beautiful. If you pull up these images online, they're all publicly available. sometimes you'll just wonder, like, are these even real? Because they're just so beautiful. But they are real, I can assure you.
We're talking with Ryan Watkins, who's a research scientist at Washington University in St. Louis, where she studies planetary surfaces and integrates planetary data to look at landing sites for future missions. We're spending the hour on the moon and the Artemis mission, taking your questions as well about the NASA work at 800-642-1234. So, Ryan, there is a lot going on at NASA through this Artemis space mission. There's the space launch system. There's Orion. There's these lunar landers. There's a lunar gateway. How does everything have to come together in order to get these NASA astronauts on the moon by 2024?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of pieces that need to come together. Kind of one of the primary ones right now is selecting a company that will essentially build and distribute the lander for the Artemis program. So NASA has really done a great job in the last few years of involving commercial companies. We have a program called the Commercial Lunar Payload Services, or CLPS for short, program. And right now there's three companies, Blue Origin's kind of a got a team of companies, including Lockheed Martin and a few others.
And that's Jeff Bezos behind that. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. I serve on their science advisory board for their lander, so I know a little bit more about that one. But there's also SpaceX and Dynetics. And these three companies are currently bidding and competing to build the lander that will send the humans. So that's one big piece. Those selections will be made, I think, early next year. But then, yeah, there's also an Artemis science definition team. So they're kind of working on what are the big science questions we want the astronauts to answer. So that's a piece. Like you said, there's SLS, you know, that needs to be tested and ready to go. So it is just a lot of pieces that need to come together. To some degree, they're, you know, these teams need to be working with each other to figure out, okay, which landing site do we go to? What are the science questions? What are the exploration questions? Where can we, you know, rove if we have a rover, or walk if our humans are going to be traversing, you know, and then, yeah, the gateway, you know, when are we going to launch it? You know, how is it going to interface with, you know, the surface system? So for those who aren't familiar, the gateway is kind of like a space station that'll be hanging out over by the moon and doing a lot of interfacing with, you know, rovers and humans on the surface. So, you know, how do they all come together is kind of a big question. But like you said, there are a lot of things that need to be developed, tested, or I guess built. We'll go back a step, built, developed, tested. And really just ready to go in just a couple of short years here.
And so is NASA laying the groundwork to basically establish some sort of infrastructure at the South Pole? What is there already?
Yeah, so there is nothing there at the moment. I think the goal is to build up to that, to have kind of more permanent semi-permanent architecture there, have a habitat where humans can visit on a regular basis, get a regular cadence of missions to the South Pole. There's going to be some precursor missions that will go before the astronauts. These kinds of missions will look for things like volatiles and the presence of water ice and good places that those things can be extracted. The idea is to kind of build up from this single first Artemis mission to kind of a cadence of missions on a regular basis that will keep a sustained human presence at the lunar South Pole.
I noticed that Nokia got the contract last week for cell service on the moon, and made a huge eye roll. Not like there are any spots where we can't get cell service here on Earth.
yeah, I have not read a lot about that, but I did get a kind of a little chuckle out of the headline when I saw that.
Yeah. Ryan Watkins is our lunar guide. She's a research associate at Washington University in St. Louis. Should the U.S. be making plans to return to the moon? What other space missions should NASA prioritize? Would you be a space tourist if you could? How do you feel about NASA's plan to explore Mars? Do you think it's possible to inhabit Mars, and should we? Join in. Big questions this hour, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with planetary scientist Ryan Watkins here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about NASA's plans for the moon and beyond. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The space agency announced 14 American contracts last week to develop technologies for missions to the moon and Mars. And the Artemis program aims to land American astronauts, including the first woman, on the lunar surface by 2024. Nations are signing on to what's called the Artemis Accords to improve cooperation and peaceful exploration. What do you want to say about NASA's space program? What kind of experiments do you think astronauts should be doing on the moon? Do you remember watching Neil Armstrong walk on the moon? It's 800-642-1234. We have planetary scientist Ryan Watkins, who studies rocket exhaust effects at prior moon landing sites, and she's our guide. So, Ryan, let's talk a little bit further about SLS and the Space Launch System, because getting that spacecraft up into orbit and to the moon is a very difficult thing. Watching a takeoff is amazing, but I cannot imagine the astrophysics that had to go into that.
Yeah. I'm not a rocket scientist, but yes, it is very difficult. If you just think back to the Apollo days, the Saturn V rocket that they had to launch to get the astronauts there, it was massive. I don't know if you've ever got to walk alongside, kind of one of the models at any of the space centers, but it is huge. You've got to launch, that degree of mass. It's got to get, maybe into Earth orbit before it even goes to the moon. Often there are pieces that you have to connect while you're in orbit. Then you've got to go in lunar orbit and then, land on the surface. So there's a lot of physics, orbital mechanics involved for sure.
And so spacesuits have changed, apparently, mm-hmm. and they're going to be fitting a woman's body more. Can you tell us
about
that?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know a lot of details about the spacesuits, but yes, there is a lot of work going into them at the moment. Not just to fit a woman's body, although that is one kind of, I guess, important thing, because with the Artemis program, kind of the big call is to send the first woman and the next man back to the surface of the moon. And I think most of us realize that women are either shaped differently or sometimes we're often smaller. And so historically, the spacesuits just haven't maybe fit as well. But really, the biggest problem with spacesuits has been flexibility. So if you talk to Apollo astronauts or read things from the Apollo days, they'll tell you things like the gloves, like it was really hard to grab things or really hard to bend over. So a lot of work's really being put into the spacesuits right now to just make it easier to maneuver, to walk around, in addition to fitting just a wider range of body types.
I think I was looking at images last week where there's a big pool and they're underwater mm-hmm. in these spacesuits. What's that like?
Yeah, so that's called the Neutral Buoyancy Lab. It's at NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston, which is where they do a lot of astronaut training. So, yeah, the idea with that is it's a good environment to simulate weightlessness. So, being in water is very similar to being weightless. So it's a good place for astronauts to essentially don these spacesuits and go down and just practice the various things that they would be doing, on their spacewalks or during their missions while in a spacesuit to kind of get them acclimated to that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Ryan Watkins, who's a member of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Camera Science Team, and she uses images to understand physical properties of the lunar surface. We're looking at the Artemis mission this hour, taking your questions. What do you think about NASA's plan to land the first woman and next man on the moon? We're at 800-642-1234. Ryan, what do we know about some of the big science questions that the Artemis mission wants to take on?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I would say right now we don't have that fully fleshed out. So I mentioned a little bit earlier, there is an Artemis science definition team. So this team was formed actually very recently mostly within NASA, but they're taking input from the science community as a whole to really kind of define the key science questions to be addressed, specifically by the first Artemis mission, which we're calling Artemis 3, because there's a couple of orbital ones before the landed one. Also science questions that can be addressed through, a longer cadence of regular missions. So I can't sit here and give you a list of these are the top three questions, but There are several good, important questions at the South Pole, one of which being going back to the water ice, how much is there? What is the distribution? How deep is it? So that's a big question, is just understanding the distribution of ice on the moon. There are other things like, what is the nature of the regolith? So regolith is kind of our fancy term for the soil on the moon. So what's the nature of the regolith in the South Polar regions? Because, these areas may have, again, water ice, they're just exposed to different temperature environments than areas on the moon that we've explored. So we don't really know what the surface is actually like at the polar regions. So there's a lot to learn about, the surface properties and then the composition. We don't have samples from that area. So what are the rocks made of? And so there's a long list of questions mm-hmm. I could go through here. Another big one that I should mention is kind of the area they're landing in is actually in the largest and oldest basin on the moon. Now, a basin is essentially just like a really big crater. So this basin is called the South Pole Aitken Basin. It's again the largest and oldest basin on the moon, but we don't have an exact age for it. Being able to date this may actually tell us a lot about the timing of impacts throughout the whole inner solar system, and a lot about our kind of solar system formation and evolution up to about 4.5 billion years ago. So getting some age dates of this basin can really help constrain the chronology of impact history on the moon and the inner solar system. So there's questions related to lunar science that we can answer with the Artemis program, but these also extend on to solar system science as well.
Sounds like it can unlock a bit of mystery from the solar system there with that specific location. So does it take astronauts to actually be there to get these questions solved? I mean, we've got the technology, we've got the cameras and the rovers and all of that. Can we solve these problems remotely?
Yeah, so this is a question that comes up a lot. And honestly, that there's a lot that robots can do right now, especially if you can get a rover. But humans will honestly never replace the need, or sorry, rovers and robots will never replace the need for humans. Humans are a lot more efficient on any planetary body. Granted, we've never been anywhere else, but I'm going to assume this will also extend to other planetary bodies. We're a lot more efficient than robots. So a human can see a rock over there and say, that looks interesting, I need to go to it. A robot, on the other hand, will say, hey, I see a rock over there. I need to send a code back to the team on Earth and wait for them to tell me whether I need to drive over there. Then it's probably going to take me way longer to drive over there than it would take a human to get over there. So just like everything just takes a lot longer. So again, it's just you kind of have that real time knowledge from humans that can just say, hey, I was doing this task, but really this other task needs to be done based on this thing I've just observed. So there's a lot more efficiency, again, that can be done. Now, there are other things that robots are really great at, things like, grabbing samples and sending them back to Earth. We can analyze those on Earth. But again, if you have a human there, they can take more measurements of, well, this is what the state of this rock is before I even touch it. We call it geological context. It was at the base of this boulder orientated that way. And, even though robots can take pictures and things like that, there's just a lot more that humans can do. So yes, we can answer some of these questions with robots, but really just getting humans there is just going to make everything a lot more efficient.
Getting them there, though, it may also take a lot of time, whereas, putting the technology up there may not take as much time. So it's like, I think it's a little bit between, six of one or half a dozen of the other in a way. Can you explain a little bit about rocket exhaust? Because your research looks at rocket exhaust, and what are you trying to figure out?
Yeah, so when you land on the moon, again, because you're landing a rocket, obviously, the rocket exhaust actually will blow soil at very, very high velocities. So the soil on the moon, the regolith, is very compact. So you're not, digging a crater with your rocket exhaust. You're essentially just blowing the really fine stuff very far away at very high speeds. So there are a couple of reasons that I'm interested in looking at this. One is for safety purposes. If you land a rocket blowing dust at high speeds next to a habitat you've built, you don't want to damage that habitat. So you need to understand the nature of this blowing dust. How far is it going? How fast is it going? What angles is it blowing at? And then the other kind of big reason to look at these effects is, what is the rocket exhaust actually physically doing to the surface? And this is important primarily for things like sampling strategies. If you want to land and take a sample and return it to Earth and say, you know, this is a pristine sample that I got from the moon, then if you get it right in that area where you've landed, it may be altered to some degree. It may have its particle size distribution changed, or things like that. So it's just really helpful for understanding sampling strategies. But again, the safety component is also a big one. And right now there's been some modeling done to show that these dust particles actually blow at velocities high enough to reach the escape velocity of the moon and enter lunar orbit. So now you also have to be concerned with things like orbiting hardware, like Gateway, for example. You don't want to be sandblasting Gateway with these particles that you're blowing during landing. So it's a very complicated problem with a lot of factors, but it's also very important and very interesting.
We have Ryan Watkins with us for the hour. She's a research associate at Washington University in St. Louis. As we explore the work of NASA, the goals for space exploration, what questions do you have about spacesuits, spaceships, preparations for Artemis 3? What would you pack if you were going to the moon? Should we be going to the moon and one day Mars? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with planetary scientist Ryan Watkins right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we talk about NASA's goal to build a lunar space station, land astronauts on the surface of the moon by 2024 as part of the Artemis mission. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. Artemis will be the first crewed lunar mission since the Apollo missions, which took place between 1969 and 72. Astronauts will launch aboard the Orion spaceship. What do you think of the Artemis program? What questions do you have about the moon's south pole and the spacesuits? Join in 800-642-1234. Ryan Watkins is a research scientist with the Planetary Science Institute, and she's our guide. Let's take a call now. Cindy is with us from Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I'll tell you what, I think this is a huge waste of money right now. We have so many problems on this Earth. We have, we're in the midst of a health crisis. We have a mental health crisis, this pandemic that isn't seeming to be under control. We have climate crisis going on. We have poverty going on. We have children that don't get food at night. We've got millions and millions of dollars of problems to fix on our Earth. I say we fix these first, then we can go to the moon or Mars.
All right, Cindy. So, you know, Cindy bringing up, Ryan, just the immense cost and other issues that should be a priority here on Earth. What is the cost of this exploration?
Yeah, that's actually not a question I know the answer to in terms of what is the exact cost. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be, you know, millions of, I don't know if we've hit the billions of dollars range, but you know, building a new rocket and a new lander and things like that are very expensive. But again, that is actually one reason that NASA has begun utilizing more commercial companies. So these are private companies that are not funded by the government. And so it actually is more cost effective in terms of, you know, what NASA is paying for these companies to develop things. A lot of these companies, you know, they're businesses, so they're for profit. And so, you know, they have strategies in place to get their own revenue and things like that. So, these concerns are definitely valid ones. But one thing we like to always remind people is that NASA's portion of the federal budget is incredibly small. I want to say it's less than 1%. It might even be smaller than that. It's definitely smaller than 1%, but it's very small. So the amount of taxpayer funded money that's actually going into this is very minor. And there are actually, you know, a lot of strategies with space exploration that are addressing some of these concerns that Cindy brought up. You know, there are a lot of scientists at NASA who are actively working on things like climate change. So, going to the moon isn't going to, solve world hunger or anything like that. But it does help us address a lot of questions about our own planet's formation and history, and really tells us a lot about our planet and how we can take care of it. I have something I was going to say. What was it? Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say also NASA produced its first ever economic impact report last month, and it showed $65 billion in economic impact supporting 312,000 jobs in the U.S. So quite a reach on investment there.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, you know, some people, you know, they think of NASA and they think of, you know, Mars or moon, but NASA does so much more. NASA has a huge earth science, heliophysics, you know, astrobiology, you know, all of these different programs within NASA. So, so they are, you know, working on some of these, you know, questions that may be of larger concern to our society as well.
Let's bring in Joe in Nina. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hello. Hello, Ryan. I'm a solar system ambassador for NASA JPL in the area. I wanted to know if NEMO is being used to prepare astronauts for activities on the moon. Maybe you don't know, NEMO is the NASA Extreme Environment Missions Operations in Key Largo, Florida, where they're rehearsing these techniques for asteroid mining and lunar mining, et cetera. Is there a correct connection between NEMO and Artemis yet?
Yeah, so I am actually familiar with NEMO. I actually even know a few people who have participated in that program. Again, you know, this is a kind of program where it's, underwater training for different things. I do not know yet if they have a direct connection between preparing for Artemis. I would honestly be surprised if they're not doing that or at least preparing for that. I know several people who work directly with astronauts are involved in NEMO, so I imagine that at some point the astronauts who will be going to the surface of the moon will most likely be utilizing something, either whether it's NEMO or something similar, you know, this kind of training underwater to prepare.
Joe, may I ask, what do you think of the Artemis mission?
I think it's a great expansion of human intellect. I mean, look at all these people that we're encouraging to...
Oh, I think we just lost you there. There we go. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was just saying that it's a great opportunity for people who study STEM disciplines to put it to work, either on Earth in the environment or in space, because the trickle-down effect from the space program is tremendous over the last few years. There are many technologies we've developed that have helped the environment. So those who think we shouldn't be in space, we need a challenge for our scientists. We need people to take up those disciplines and go forward.
Oh, and I think we lost you there, but Joe mentioned STEM, Ryan, and I know that you are deeply involved in the local community in your area with science, technology, engineering, and math, and really building up the STEM workforce. What does that work entail?
Yeah, so I do, like you said, I do kind of a lot of outreach. Typically, you know, schools or other, you know, libraries, places like that will reach out to me. So I do a lot of speaking, and mainly, you know, I honestly have done all age groups from, you know, small children to adults. I'll do things at the St. Louis Arch with kind of educational programs, just really to educate people on what the kind of visions and goals of NASA are. You know, sometimes I'll talk about, you know, the moon specifically in terms of, you know, what are we currently learning and from LRO. What are we going to be doing when we send humans back to the moon? But yeah, just really trying to show people that, you know, there's a variety of, you know, like you said, the STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, a variety of STEM fields that kind of go into play with what NASA is doing. And really just try to kind of encourage children, if they're interested in this, then, you know, it may seem like a big thing as a kid, you know, hey, you know, someone works at NASA or they're an astronaut. That's just like, you know, it's a huge thing to a kid. You know, a lot of them grow up saying, I'm going to be an astronaut when I grow up. But just really showing them that these things are real, they're tangible and they're achievable, I think is important. As a child, I was made fun of for wanting to make, for wanting a career at NASA. So I really like to just tell children that, you know, you can set these goals and you can go for them regardless of what people say. So I do, do a lot of outreach just to really kind of raise awareness for what NASA is doing and for what kind of career opportunities are available.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Ryan Watkins. She is a research scientist with the Planetary Science Institute, and we're spending the hour on efforts to return to the moon and what the Artemis mission looks like, taking your questions as well. How do you feel about NASA's current plans? Do you think it's possible humans could inhabit Mars in the future? What other space exploration should we be involved in? Join in at 800-642-1234. I'm wondering, Ryan, you know, we've heard about the Artemis Accords. What is the collaboration look like for Artemis and for other work that NASA has underway, collaboration with other countries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, this is something I don't know a lot of details about, but yeah, so several countries, I think it was just last week or the week before, just signed the Artemis Accords. And as far as I understand it, I think this is kind of like sort of an agreement type thing for returning to the surface of the moon. So NASA really does want international partnership and collaboration as we return to the surface of the moon. If you look at, you know, the ISS, the International Space Station, for example, this was a huge international effort. And it's just kind of been this really beautiful thing that many countries have come together to do in space. So, you know, kind of similar for the moon. Again, I don't know what, you know, the specifics are, you know, if different countries will be developing different hardware or anything. But often on NASA missions, there may be, or even, you know, international missions, there's often instruments that are contributed from other countries. You know, sometimes NASA contributes an instrument to a foreign space mission. So these are just really great ways for countries to kind of work together to achieve the science and exploration goals that kind of we all have together. So, you know, the moon's not really, you know, this, you know, it's, you know, a lot of countries want to go there. Mm. I don't want to say it's a competition per se, but really when we work together, it's a lot easier to get there in a cost-effective and timely manner. So again, yeah, I don't know all the details of the Artemis Accords, but I do believe it's just this kind of big effort for countries to work together to get humans back to the moon.
Let's take another call now. Michael is joining us from the Fox Valley. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you. One thing I mentioned, NASA's budget is so small compared to the other social programs we have to take care of people in this country. We do a reasonably good job of taking care of the poor. I grew up in the 60s with the space program. We are a species of explorers. We have to reach out and explore and know, or else what are we? That's what human beings do.
Mm. Michael, thank you for that. You know, Michael is saying that this space exploration is in our DNA, Ryan.
Yeah, I fully agree. On a lot of my outreach talks, I have a slide where I start with that, where, you know, you look at Lewis and Clark, Magellan, you know, we've been exploring for as long as we can remember in our human history. It's just part of our genes to explore. So I don't think space is off limits, because that's just how we were wired, is to get out there and explore.
Now, with Blue Origin, the rocket company, they launched a rocket into space to test NASA's moon landing technologies, and mm-hmm. that happened recently. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was the end of last week. Yep.
Yeah. Can you tell us what that entails?
Again, I don't know a lot of the specifics of, mm-hmm. of the technology itself, but I believe it was some technologies to perhaps look at probably hazards and different things during landing. So these Blue Origin launches, they're suborbital. So they go up and they land again on Earth. So I believe they were testing some technologies to study things like, you know, relative terrain hazards.
Ryan Watkins studies rocket exhaust effects from past moon landing sites to plan for future missions. She's a research associate at Washington University in St. Louis. Should the U.S. be making plans to return to the moon? What other space missions should be the priority? Would you be a space tourist if you could? What would you bring? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Ryan Watkins here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on NASA and the Artemis program to return astronauts to the moon by 2024. Going into space is big business. NASA released its first economic impact report recently and said it generated nearly $65 billion in economic impact during the fiscal year 2019. Ryan Watkins watches what comes out of NASA as an associate research scientist with the Planetary Science Institute. She's our guide. Ryan, I want to return to the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera, the LROC, that you work with and these images. How do you know when you're looking at an image that you have something that's going to really help solve a problem?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good question. I think it partly depends on what you're looking at. So we do have a lot of knowledge of the lunar surface, even just from, you know, the Apollo missions and missions that have gone before LRO. So often we know areas to look at to try to, you know, get more information about a science question we're trying to solve. But other times, you know, things will surprise you. You might be poking around an image and you see, you know, a crack in the ground or a strange looking crater with maybe dark material around it that's unusual for the moon. So really it's just kind of having this visual acuity to really just notice like something is out of place here or is not like the other things I'm used to seeing when I look at features that are like this. So there's no, you know, tried and true recipe for identifying things that are going to help you solve a problem. But and oftentimes it takes integrating different data sets, you know, beyond just optical imagery. You might need, you know, thermal data or slope data or other things.
Oh, so you're layering the image on other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oftentimes, I mean, you can use the images by themselves to get a lot of great data, but it really becomes a more robust scientific investigation when you do pull in other data sets, both from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has other instruments on board, but even older data sets can really prove valuable when you bring in compositional information, again, like other things about the topography and the slopes and the rock abundance. So really, we can do some really great science investigations when we just bring all of these things together.
And so when you're looking at these images, is it just like on a computer screen, or do you have special instrumentation to see the images and be able to zoom in and out?
Yeah, so I mean, it's all done on a computer. We do have special programs that we can use. A lot of this is actually done. A lot of us use GIS, which is, you know, software that a lot of people use. We do have special, you know, software that's kind of built by the USGS to help us process these images. But when it comes to actually viewing them and like poking around in them, yeah, it's just on our computer. There's actually a public website called QuickMap. If you just Google QuickMap and LRO, you'll find it, where all of these images and data sets are actually just available for the public to poke around in. You can see all of these. You can click layers on and off. You can go to the Apollo sites. It's just a really neat product to look at. So yeah, we do it mostly on the computer.
And then what kind of math are you doing as you try to solve some of these problems?
Yeah. Again, that's going to vary depending on who you're talking to. But for me personally, again, because I do photometry, I study reflectance properties, I use what we call Hapke modeling. These are basically radiative transfer models where, you know, there are these long string of equations that nobody really wants me to get into on the radio. but within these equations are parameters that depend on things like composition, grain size, physical properties of the surface. So we can really kind of use these models and these equations to pull out some of this information about the surface, given the images that we have.
We're talking with Ryan Watkins, who's a research scientist with the Planetary Science Institute. We're spending the hour on efforts to return to the moon and what she studies. Ryan, you know, we haven't talked about Mars, the M word, you know, which can be pretty controversial because it's difficult to get there and we're working on it. There's a rover that is apparently on its way to Mars. What are efforts like there for this exploration?
Yep. So I'll just preface this with, I don't do Mars things. Like you said, it's the M word, but Mars is a great place to be exploring too. So the rover that you mentioned is the Perseverance rover. So if anyone's familiar with Curiosity, which is kind of the bigger rover that's active on Mars right now, it's essentially, I don't want to say it's its twin, but it was kind of designed similarly. It has different instruments and things, but it is on its way to Mars. I think it's landing February timeframe of early next year. And so this rover, like many others, will be looking for, you know, traces of life in the soil and the rocks as it traverses. It's going to be landing in a crater, Jezero, that may have had, you know, kind of water flowing at one point. And so kind of one big thing, though, with this upcoming mission is it's actually going to be taking samples and doing what we call caching them. So basically just storing them for a potential later mission to come and retrieve and return back to Earth. So sample return on Mars is a lot more difficult than it is for the moon. You know, it's a lot farther away. There's just a lot more complicating factors in terms of landing on Mars, launching off Mars, etc. So this rover is actually going to go identify samples that are interesting and then leave them for a future mission to return to Earth.
Would those samples be locked away inside the rover, or at where would the rover put the samples?
Yeah, so I think they're actually going to just be dropping them in strategically placed locations. I don't know if they've identified those locations ahead of time or not, or if it's kind of something that's done in real time. But yeah, so I don't think they'll be stored on the rover itself. They'll actually be leaving them in very well-documented places for, again, a future mission.
And so this rover will also send images back, I would assume, that are really eye-opening and should give us a lot more information.
Yeah, for sure. You know, pretty much almost all good planetary science missions have a really great camera. And so this rover will be no different. It will take really great images, especially to kind of gather that context for where it collected these samples. That's going to be really key, since you don't have, again, the human there to record those things. So the pictures will be really valuable. I'm sure we'll learn a lot more about, you know, potential and, you know, ancient water on Mars and different things and what these samples are made of and kind of what the geologic history of Mars was.
So how difficult is it to land a rover and not make it go poof? I mean, you know, this is a really hot place.
Yeah. So landing on Mars is really difficult. A lot more so than the moon. And it's partly because of this, because it does have an atmosphere. You know, it's not as, you know, the gravity is not as high and the atmosphere is not as thick as Earth. But you need to slow something down when you're landing on Mars. All temperature things aside, you've got to slow something down enough to land safely. If anybody remembers Curiosity's landing, you know, it was the 7 minutes of terror, and they used the sky crane that essentially, you know, dropped the rover down on a tether. And it was one of these things where the delay in communication was 7 minutes long. So there was this gap of time where you're like, it's either there or it's not. And we've got to wait 7 minutes for the signal. the older rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, they landed in these kind of airbag type things that bounced along the surface. So, going back to rocket exhaust effects, the larger your lander is on Mars, the more likely you are to dig a crater, which is a hazard, especially if you're sending humans. So landing on Mars is very difficult, which is kind of one of the reasons for doing these multifaceted approaches. It's, you know, one of the many reasons that, you know, it's a little bit harder to get humans there. It's just, you know, this landing component. When you bring in humans, you have other things to consider too, like radiation and surviving and things. So landing on Mars is pretty difficult, but at the same time, we've done it. So we know strategies that work. We know a lot about how to do it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we thought the moon was complicated. Mars is a whole different ballgame.
It really is. Yes, that's for sure.
Well, we only have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering, what excites you about this work that's going on right now? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there is a lot. And I'd say, just kind of from a personal side, I'm what we consider early career. So I am young enough to have not lived through the days of Apollo. So for many people my age, even people a little bit older, because it has been 50 years, you know, since we've been on the moon. This is our Apollo. You know, we didn't have that moment of seeing humans step on the moon for the first time. And even though this won't be the first time, we will live to see the first woman take, you know, a step on the moon. But just to really see humans get back to another planetary body, that is the most exciting thing for me, just to really get to witness and be involved in that.
Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Ryan Watkins is a research scientist who studies planetary surfaces with the Planetary Science Institute. She's a research associate at Washington University in St. Louis. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.